Thanks so much for tuning in this week. My name is Scott Cunningham. This is the mixtape with Scott Cunningham. Or rather, the mixtape with Scott. It's not so formal. I'm a professor at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and this is a podcast that is devoted to listening to the stories of living economists. This week's economist is Martin Gaynor. He's a professor at Carnegie Mellon and has now moved into the Department of Justice to work on topics in antitrust. He's historically focused on health, health care in particular. And this work that he's going to continue has to do with the market organization, the market concentration, IO questions related to health care. We had a wonderful talk. And unfortunately, after the cameras quit rolling, there was even more wonderful talks that we had. He's a fabulous economist with a very interesting journey that did not start out very well by any measure. One measure of a career starting out is you get a job. And Marty sort of bounced around in visiting positions and then even left academia because he couldn't get a job and then bounced back, or rather didn't bounce back, but managed. He always wanted to be back in academia, and he got back in and ended up at Johns Hopkins, which was a huge fortunate turn of events. So it's a story of a lot of things. It's a story of a lot of things: resiliency, getting second chances, and things like that. But Marty also is the survivor of a synagogue mass murder that happened in 2018 at the Tree of Life Synagogue, and he shares those events with us. It was a really nice interview, and I felt a lot of kinship with Marty, how he's interpreted the experiences of his life, his positivity, his constant optimism, and how he's managed to, respond to those tragedies. I felt really inspired that I was around a great person, a really great person, a real spiritual master. And I hope that you enjoy this as much as I did. I hope that it moves you as much as it did me. It's a little bit longer, but I think it's worth it. Thanks again so much for tuning in. Tell your people about the podcast and about the Substack, and tell them all their wildest dreams will come true if they listen to it. See you in a minute. Bye. Well, it's a pleasure to have with me someone I got to know on Twitter for a long time, and then we haven't spoken in a while. Guest, could you, for the sake of the listener, tell us your full name, your full title, and where you work now, and maybe where you were working until just recently?
Okay, sure. Yeah. Hi, Scott. Great to be with you. And again, it's sort of one of those fortuitous things. There are some pretty toxic stuff about Twitter, but there's some really wonderful things as well. And Twitter brought us together, and I'm really, really grateful for that.
Me too.
So my name's Martin Gaynor. I go by Marty, unless a very formal situation, or my mother of blessed memory used to address as Martin when she was really annoyed with me. But Marty Gaynor. And I'm a professor at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The full 6-bit title is E.J. Barone University Professor of Economics and Public Policy. I'm at the Heinz College of Information Systems and Policy and something else, and courtesy appointment in the Tepper School of Business. I've been here since 1995, so quite a long time. And I'm also serving in the antitrust division of the U.S. Department of Justice. I'm a special advisor to Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust, Jonathan Cantor, and I'm working with the economists and lawyers there on a variety of issues, some more policy-oriented, some possible enforcement-oriented, a lot of them focusing around healthcare and health insurance.
Awesome. Awesome. I can't wait to get into a little bit of that at the end. This is not your first time to be a public servant, though, right?
No, this is the second time. Actually, about 10 years ago, I was the director of the Bureau of Economics at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, basically the chief economist there. And so I was really grateful that time to have the opportunity to serve the country, serve the people of the United States. And I'm really grateful I was given the opportunity this time as well. I really appreciate it. It's deeply meaningful to me. And I certainly hope that I am doing some things, of course, not on my own, but along with everybody else, both back then, those days, and also now, to help try to make the country a better place for all of us who live here and love America.
Well, let's start with an icebreaker. What's a vacation that you went on? It could be any time in your life, that enough time has passed, though, that you've noticed, it doesn't have to be your favorite vacation, but you've noticed that you've thought about it at least twice for some reason.
There's probably not a single one that fits that description, but I will come up with three. One, after I graduated from college, and I graduated a term early. I went to University of California at San Diego, and I graduated. They had quarters, three, so I graduated after the winter quarter, and I'd saved up some money. Parenthetically, it turns out tuition at the University of California back then was $636 a year. That's
Okay. A
how
little bit
long
different now, I heard.
a little different now, but I was able to work part-time during the school year and work during the summers. It was easy to get summer jobs then. There were still, factory jobs and things like that, and earn enough money and have actually plenty left over. So anyhow, I graduated. I accumulated enough credits, and I had saved some money, so I left and I hitchhiked around Europe and Israel, and it was just an incredible experience, including, weirdly enough, a near-death experience. I got hit by a car on the autostrada just outside of Florence, Italy, and I ended up in the hospital there for a number of days, and I had a concussion, and I had some pretty a deep cut on my head and a very deep wound on my leg. But actually, I otherwise survived unscathed, which shouldn't have happened. I was wearing a backpack, and I think that's what saved my life. But anyhow, I ended up in this ward in an Italian hospital in Florence. Nobody spoke English. All these. It looked like a scene from a set of The Farewell to Arms. All these beds, what white metal, painted white metal, and all these people, Italian guys, there was all men, had their families visit them, and they all came over and they said, "Oh, you have no mama here, you have no papa," and they brought me food. And at lunchtime, you were served this big meal, like with pasta and either fish or meat and a half liter of wine. So I'm not drinking the wine, and they come over. The nurse, unfortunately, not Gina Lollobrigida's little sister, but some guy Vito, but a great guy, says, "What's the matter? You're not drinking the wine. Are you sick?" I said, "I'm in the hospital. What do you think?" And they're like, "Oh, we were worried about you because everybody else is drinking wine. You should be, right?" I'm like, "Well, okay, if that's what the nurse ordered." So anyhow, it was a scary experience in
I
many ways,
bet.
but in some ways, it was really cool, and I became friends with this guy. His name was not Vito, sorry, but it was, an Italian guy, the nurse, a great guy. And afterwards, I got out. He took me for a ride on his Moto Guzzi motorcycle, a very cool motorbike. And people there were incredibly nice to me. And in some ways, it actually was a very positive experience. So anyhow, that was a very memorable trip, and I think back not just to that, but to other aspects. It was the very first time I was in the state of Israel and saw family members there, and made a whole bunch of friends. And then after my wife and I got married, actually I took the summer off. I was teaching at University of Texas at Arlington at that point, and we traveled around Europe for about 3 months on our own. Had a lot of adventures. We're on a train in Germany and put my backpack at the end of the train, and then went to get it. And it turns out the cars had separated, and my pack, it turned out, was on a car that went somewhere else. And
you do like a running leap to get to
that.
The
we didn't know
car.
What had happened. It was just gone. So we get off the train in Ulm, go. And of course, there's an office for the railway police, and they're there. And we write out this report, and like, whatever, you know, that's it. It's gone. And months later, we get home, and I don't know, like 6 months later, this package comes from the German railroad, and the backpack is in it. Everything is neatly folded, like my underwear is neatly folded. And the only thing that was missing was one roll of film, which must have fallen out. It was just like, you know, conformed to the national stereotype. You know, everything was organized. They got it to the right address. That was really incredible. So that was a weird mishap, but in some ways, again, turned out great. And then about a couple of years ago, well, we're going to talk about this a little later, but I'm a survivor of the attack on the Tree of Life synagogue here in Pittsburgh back in 2018. One thing that came about in the aftermath of that was, you know, thousands and thousands of people just felt awful about what happened. And what a lot of people did is they donated money. I think, you know, they wanted to do something, right? And there was a commission that was put together to decide what to do with the money. And to get to the point, the folks on the commission decided that people who were survivors, people who lost family members, et cetera, should get certain amounts of money. So I got a certain amount of money from this fund. Initially, I didn't want the money at all. It actually made me very upset. I wanted to give it back or something. But my wife pointed out, look, the reason you have this is because there's all these people out there wanted to do something, and they want you to have this, and they want you to do something with it that makes you feel good. So I'm getting to the point. I decided to use it to take a trip with my wife and our kids and their significant others or friends. And we went to this little island in the Caribbean called Jost Van Dyke in the British Virgin Islands. It's a very isolated, just beautiful place. And we were there for, I think, a little more than a week. And we were all together, including some of our kids, significant others that we didn't necessarily know all that well, or even and they had met before, but we all got along great. Everybody had a lovely time. It was just wonderful and relaxing and enjoyable. And so those are all trips I actually think back on, I'd say more than twice. There are others, but those I'd say are three that really, really come to mind.
Well, that's amazing that you can, I've heard, you know, a therapist told me and that, when bad things happen to you, you only really have two choices. You can either find the gift in it, or you have to let it go. And because the third option will destroy your life. And you know, it seems like you've got some practiced habit or something where you're going to find some gift in it. Is that an accurate kind of response to you?
I think that's right. And I don't know that it's something I thought about consciously. I mean, after the shooting, it's something I did think about consciously. I did get a lot of help, but I think things happen to us that are beyond our control. I got hit by a car.
Yeah.
Right. And I was very seriously hurt there. You know, my backpack ended up on a train, like somewhere, we don't even know where it went to. In Germany, you have no control over those things. Some of these things are really awful and terrible. Yeah. There's no question about it. The only thing you have some degree of control over is how you respond. And I think people need to know also, being realistic and charitable with oneself, that things happen, they're upsetting. It's okay, like, not to view it as a gift initially.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, oh, totally.
Something like, you knock over your glass of milk, right? I mean, I actually sometimes do things like that, knock over a glass of water or whatever, and get very upset. Initially, that's natural, and that's fine. But over time, when we have a chance to process and accept and get away from the moment, then I think we can try to be conscious and deliberate about these things and make an effort. And again, it's
and
not
the
always-
timing of it, there's seasonalities, you know, there's a it's not always appropriate to do anything other than just recognize your own feelings, you know, and that's really a compassionate thing to do to yourself, is to just recognize your feelings and just, and feel them.
Look, we've all had the experience. This is a podcast about economists and economics where submit a paper. And right. Boy, when you submit that paper the first time, it's like, oh my goodness, this is the greatest thing ever.
How is this not going to just make everyone go crazy?
Okay, I want to be modest, but Nobel Prize. Yeah, I can see that. Right. You know, I don't own a pair of tails. I might have to, right? You're riding high. And then most of the time, guess what happens? Months later, you get it back and it's rejected. And sometimes it's even apart.
Totally brutal. Yeah.
It feels terrible.
It does feel terrible. I know.
It feels terrible, right? Yeah. And eventually, you know, what we do is he's like, okay, you know, I'm really mad. Those people are dopes and they don't recognize greatness when they say blah, 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 right?
Right.
But you get past that and you get to the point where you say, okay, here are some things to take away that are actually useful from this. Maybe I'm even grateful for some of the things these people said. Maybe I still think they're hopes, but
right.
And you move forward with it. You know, that's not like having a near-death experience,
right.
Obviously remotely close, but it you know, can be very emotional, and we have to learn to permit ourselves to feel upset, to feel rejected, angry, whatever it may be. But then to find a place for that, but then to move forward, not let that hold us back.
Yeah. No, totally.
It's important professionally.
That's right. And in your relationships, and being a partner and a son and a brother and a father and a colleague. I mean, it's a practice. It's a skill. It's a kind of human capital, I think. You know?
Yeah.
Well, so where did you grow up and what did your parents do for a living?
Yeah, so I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and that's where my mother, may she rest in peace, is from originally. My dad was there going to grad school at Case Institute of Technology, now Case Western
Reserve
University. He and my mother met, and they got married, and they had my sister, and then they had me, and they're living with my grandparents for a while, and then living someplace not far from the university. It's a neighborhood now called Glenville that was a heavily Jewish area at the time. Now it's mostly Black African American community, and it's been a pretty rough neighborhood for a while. I think it was never a place where people were prosperous, but you know, neighborhoods had its share of tough times.
Yeah.
And my dad got a job with General Electric, Schenectady, New York. So we moved there. And
how old were you when you moved there?
Oh, I was a baby. So, not real old. Spent a lot of time in Cleveland growing up, visiting my grandparents and my uncle, but grew up, I think through age 11 in Schenectady. Like I said, my dad worked for GE, which is still a big company, but a bigger and more important company then. And that's of course where it was based at the time. And then he took a job with Bell and Howell, which I think still exists, but is a much smaller, less important company.
You stay in New York City? This is where you grow up?
This is upstate. This is Schenectady.
Oh, upstate. Got it.
This is near Albany.
Oh, okay.
A blessed memory, originally from the Bronx, from New York. So we have a lot of family in New York, but this is upstate. So,
okay.
Then we moved to Chicago for a couple of years, and then ultimately out to the Los Angeles area. Went to junior high and high school in Los Angeles, and I went to college at UC San Diego. I mean, the University of California system is still excellent. It was excellent at the time, and like I mentioned earlier, it was really, really inexpensive. So you know, really couldn't beat that. And then I ended up going to grad school, getting my PhD at Northwestern. So does that cover more or less?
No, that's great. That's great. Yeah. I'm curious, you know, when you tell me that you moved so much and you mentioned that you even moved kind of at the rising of high school, you know, that can sometimes be really tough on a kid. I'm curious, right. You know, what was it like having to do all those moves?
Yeah, well, not something that I cared for my sister or my brothers. There are four of us, particularly cared for. And I think it was kind of tough, probably a bit harder on my sister and me. My sister's the oldest and I'm the next one.
She's the oldest. So she's moving in high school. She's moving in high school.
A bit younger, but you know, we adjusted and made good friends and certainly my sister's still in Los Angeles area in Southern California. And certainly grew to like it a great deal. Eventually, my grandparents, a blessed memory, and my uncle moved out there. So we had I think some cousins on my mother's side who lived in the LA area. So we did have some family members in the area. But yeah, it definitely took some adjustment. No question.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the Los Angeles has such a really neat part of American history. At least all I really know about it is from movies, but it, you know, the Steven Spielberg movies of being a kid there in those suburbs just seem so wonderful. And was it when you were there, did you really enjoy the culture? Like, I mean, what was it like?
Yeah, it took a while to get used to. I remember a few things were rather really surprising to us. So the schools, the hallways were open air. I mean, they might be like that in Texas too, because you have the weather for it, but they weren't enclosed. So, you know, they had a covering and a walkway, but it was open. We're like, what? Wow, this is wild. And the high school was all on one level. It was not multiple floors. It was all on one level. And that just kind of blew our minds for a while. And initially we couldn't find any good pizza anywhere.
Oh,
pizza
sure.
Was really terrible.
Completely,
right.
Right.
And sort of Mexican, or probably I should say more, you know, Mexican American food, that was a very new thing for us. So a lot of changes, but we really grew to like it. Obviously the weather is nice.
Wonderful.
And, a very outdoors oriented lifestyle, just doing so many things. Whereas that's really nice and very relaxed. I mean, kind of lifestyle too. So definitely grew to like it. Of course I moved back east and I don't think I'm ever.
You're not going back. No, you're not going back to Cleveland. Yeah. So when you were in high school, and if I could have like eavesdropped in the faculty lounge and they had been talking about Marty Gaynor, you know, what do you think they're saying about this kid? Like, you know, he's a senior and he's going to be graduating. What kind of kid did they think you were?
Probably someone who did not exert a whole lot of effort.
Really?
Graduated from high school with a 3.04 average. I don't know where that put me, my class rank. I did really well on the GREs, the SATs and the PSATs.
Uh-huh.
But I just didn't really work very hard at all. So I don't think my parents were super happy about that.
You can only go up from there. That's the good part of it.
So I think it was not a sure thing at all that I would get into UC San Diego. I probably almost certainly could have gotten into UC Riverside. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, a fine campus, but because the location was not as beautiful as some of the others, popular. Mm-hmm. So I did get in, but probably by the skin of my teeth, quite frankly. I think I was lucky to get in. But then when I got to college, I decided to exert myself and I made dean's list.
So it was always inside you. There must have just been
kid has a bad attitude.
You
know, thinks he, I don't know what, sort of is much more interested in, you know, being a pseudo hippie, you know, chasing girls, friends of mine and I, we were high school, designed, built, and flew our own hang gliders when that was a very new thing, which was really cool. It was really fun. We had a blast with it. Sort of amazing. Nobody ever got hurt.
That seems like a bunch of high school kids that are 3.0 GPA making hang gliders.
I think it was probably,
it could be a little risky.
Most of us were probably underachievers. I would guess. I don't know what
that could go either way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of our group actually did have good grades. But yeah, so I was just not real, just interested in other stuff. Excuse me. And yeah, maybe I don't know, thought school was uncool or I was too good for it. I mean, how easily can I remember my 17 or 18 year old self? Not that easily. But yeah, teachers probably thought, you know, guy's a goof off and a screw up, and I don't know, will ever make anything of himself.
But you were going to go to college.
Oh yeah. I think that was,
that wasn't really like a question.
Yeah, no, I think that was, so my father went to college on the GI Bill. He served in the Army during the Second World War. And of course the GI Bill was extended to all those veterans. Same thing for my father-in-law, blessed memory as well. And it completely changed his life. My dad, there's no way he would have gone to college, I think, otherwise, or very, very highly unlikely. So completely changed his life. And my parents were always very, very big on education. Everybody in the extended family was obviously a big deal. So that was, was expected. Now, the Vietnam War ended while I was a senior. I had a draft card and a lottery number. It was very much the tail end. So I never really felt that I was very likely to get drafted. And, you know, there were college exemptions anyhow, but
what was your card number? Would it have gotten you drafted?
I think not. I think they had instituted the lottery at that point. The lottery is a late thing. And I think I had a number such that the probability I would get drafted was extremely low. And I knew that, but.
So Josh Angris data, you're an always taker. You're always going to go, well, actually, we don't know what you were. We don't know what you were. You didn't go to college. I mean, you went to college. You didn't.
I think that,
or maybe you would have been a complier. You would have gone if you were drafted.
I do vaguely recall thinking about like, okay, you know, if I get drafted, what am I going to do? But by the time I was a senior, again, everything was really winding down. And so, you know, I mean, for guys who were older than me, like I'd say more than a year, like 2 or 3 years, that was obviously, you know, much more relevant, much, much more real for me. It was something I thought about, but I don't think it ever really seemed very likely that it would happen.
Well, so you go to UC San Diego, and you know, a lot of people that major in economics, this is the theme I've noticed, is they're like, they either have a professor, a book, or a class that seems to make a big impression. And then there's like a fourth group where, you know, it's like more, there's more heterogeneity. So I was just wondering, you know, what's causing you, if you look back, to go sort into that major?
Yeah. So, well, the major itself, and then sort of I think my decision to continue with it. So I started out, I'd been interested in science all my life. My dad was a chemical engineer. And I remember like having books about scientists, like famous scientists in our house, and sitting around as a kid and reading them. And so that was very much my aspiration. And there you had to take this very rigorous general ed, like you had to take, I think, a year plus of science, started with basic physics and continued, and then, you know, chemistry and biology, and a year of calculus and a year of humanities. And it was all in a very rigorous general ed, and not just math and science, but like I said, they had this really terrific humanities sequence as well. And you had to take social science anyhow. So I take physics, and freshman physics is, you know, the usual Newtonian mechanics stuff, you know, Tarzan swinging on a vine, that kind of thing. And I like that. I found it pretty straightforward. I'd liked physics in high school. I actually really enjoyed the physics classes. One of the teachers in that class who really motivated me, he was a bit of a smart aleck, and I think it got my attitude a little bit and kidded me around a little bit. And so physics would be really, really, and it, you know, it was sort of felt like it was like the glamour, you know, branch of the science, you know, all these famous physicists. Anyhow, well, did that, and then we get to quantum physics, quantum mechanics. I could do it, but the intuition just completely escaped me. I just did not get it at all, and I think it's a pretty common phenomenon. And that really kind of left me cold. I'm like, oh, I don't know, like, I really want to do this. And I'm good at math, but I don't think I'm like physicist or theoretical physicist good at math, right? There, you know, to be really good theoretical physicist, so you have at least some versions that you have to be basically an applied mathematician. I don't think I quite have that kind of ability. So anyhow, I was thinking, oh, I don't know about this, and oh, maybe I'll do chemistry and like biology. I didn't want to do biology because at that point in time, like the pre-med stuff was completely nuts. I had friends, you know, my roommate in college, roommate was pre-med, and all they did, you know, they ate, drank, and slept and studied all the time. People just were completely crazed about getting into medical school, and so most of them were biology majors. And I was like, I don't want to deal with that. No, no. So, I guess I must have taken freshman economics as part of the, you know, the breadth requirements. And I think it was taught with calculus. And I'm like, hey, I kind of like this. Like, I kind of get how it works because it is kind of like physics in some ways. I mean, and sort of I like that it was precise or felt precise, right? Scientific. But you're dealing with real world things, and like, well, you could do something to actually help society be a better place. So I really liked that. And I think that's what happened. I sort of then I drifted into economics, and I found that I liked it. I did well in the courses. So, and then I think I was already majoring in economics. I took an upper division course in industrial organization antitrust that was taught by Richard Schmalensee, who's at MIT, who's been at MIT now for years, but he was a young new assistant professor at UC San Diego at that time. And he teaches a class in IO, and IO was really changing a lot at that time. He went through antitrust cases as well. And I thought, wow, that's really, really interesting. I really like that, how you could bring economics to bear on these very real world, very applied problems, really get some traction and some insights. And I had taken a course in political science that was about like Supreme Court cases. We like read all this stuff and wrote briefs and stuff. I'd been thinking, well, maybe law school. And I did that, and I thought, oh my gosh, like I do not like this at all. Not belittling that. I mean, I have friends. I have some of my best friends are lawyers. I work with lawyers at DOJ all the time. I mean, I'm astounded and amazed by these people and what they can do. But for me, it wasn't for me. It was just words and words and words and words and words, and it just I just really couldn't. It didn't appeal to me, and I had trouble wrapping my head around. So that's not for me. But I kind of liked this thing, which had some combination of those. So
You sound like you had the transition into econ that I hear about a lot, which is the public policy carrot kind of pulled you in a little bit. Is that right?
yeah, I really liked the idea of doing something that could make a difference. I really did. And so it was on one hand the scientific approach economics has. I like that, and I'm comfortable with mathematics. I really something that was, again, I don't mean this to sound negative, but something that was just words wasn't such a great fit for me. But I also like that you know, was applied in the real world, and like you could work on some things that could actually help people.
Yeah,
I found
yeah,
that tremendously appealing.
Yeah. I wonder if the Vietnam War, in the shadow of the Vietnam War, was your generation just probably a lot more, you know, had this kind of in the variance of interest as a cohort of in public policy. I would just imagine you're probably have been thinking about policy questions before you even end up at college.
That's a good question, Scott. And the best answer I can give is, I don't know. I've never thought about it from that perspective, but certainly, growing up, even as a, like a younger kid and certainly high school and then college age, all that stuff was certainly in the air, being aware of it. Of course, when I was in college, like all this stuff was pretty much done there. I think were a couple occasions where there were protests on campus, but there wasn't much of that. But nonetheless, people thinking about alternative things, maybe trying to reimagine society. I remember there was a book called Small is Beautiful. I think it had just come out. Was very popular at that time and was sort of an attempt to kind of rethink some of these things. I'm not advocating for or against it. That was out there. And of course, economists were thinking seriously about environmental issues. I think that was a relatively new thing. Some other applied areas, education, health, these were all still relatively new in economics. So perhaps it could be that had an influence. But if that's the case, I do have to say it's not something I was conscious of at the time, or even until you mentioned it, I'd never thought of it.
But you've got this, you're telling the story that you said, you know, the policy does in that antitrust case, right? Antitrust class or the IO class. Those are the things popping a little bit, is the story you're telling.
Yeah, that really caught my imagination. And of course, Richard Schmalensee, Dick Schmalensee was just a wonderful teacher. I'm sure that he still is. I actually had the good fortune last fall of meeting him for the first time since then. As you may or may not know, the antitrust division at DOJ and the FTC issued new merger guidelines, and they had a series of workshops all over the place talking about them before they were formally adopted. So I was invited to be on a panel at one of these workshops in Boston, and Richard Schmalensee was in attendance, and I mentioned. We were talking about some old cases. I mentioned a case, a Real Lemon case, a super interesting case. He had covered it in that.
Oh, he covered it in the class.
And after the panel, he came up and said, "Oh, nobody's talked about that in years." I said, "Well, you know why I talked about it? Because you talked about it back in like 1974 or five, whenever it was." He said, "Oh, no kidding. I said, "Yeah, I took your class."
Oh, I bet that was cool. That was really cool for him too.
That was really
So you end up going to Northwestern. I guess at some point you're like, to fulfill my dreams, I've got to become an economist. Is that right? Like towards the end of school?
Well, it was more like, I don't really know what I want to do. And, obviously I could have looked for a job and gotten a job, and that would have been a fine thing to do, but I didn't have any particular direction. So not like I knew I really would like to get into management of department stores. I'd like to get into investment bank. I didn't have any particular direction. I'd worked for the Southern California Gas Company as a meter reader as a summer job one summer, and they told me, I really liked it, and apparently I must have done a decent job. They said, "You got a job here if you ever want to come back." So I could have. It was actually a pretty good job because you're outdoors. Of course, I'm sure the job doesn't exist anymore. I'm sure it's all electronic.
Right.
But you walk around and read people's meters, and in Southern California in the summer, it rains very, very seldom.
Right.
We're given a book with pieces of paper. This tells you how long ago this was. And each one was a meter. And you wrote in pen or pencil what the reading was. And whenever you got to the last page, you were done.
Yeah.
You hopped in your truck powered by natural gas, drove back to the central area, you know, parked the truck, turned in your book, and you went home. And we'd start at 7 in the morning. And after a few weeks, you could be done at 2 or 3 in the afternoon. So it was
yeah,
bad job at all. But anyway, I kind of was thinking, well, I don't know that that's exactly what I want to do. And I, you know, I kind of gotten turned on to the thing. And I knew law school didn't really seem like a good fit.
Well, how'd you end up at Northwestern? Is it one of these things where you're like, I'm going to go to the best school I'll get into?
Yeah, pretty much. Uh-huh. That's pretty much what happened. I was admitted at Chicago, but they had just started a degree in public policy. They didn't even have the Harris School. That didn't exist. It was like a commitment to public policy. And so they didn't admit me to economics. They admitted me to this thing. And they said, well, you know, you take all the courses, and if you do well, you can just move over to economics after, you know, a semester, a year, whatever. And they gave me a full ride. But I like, well, that's kind of risky. I don't think I want to do that. It also heard be pretty brutal there.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So
was when they were a weed out. Kind
oh, of, yeah. They admit like 100. Somebody I knew from UC San Diego, who was, I think, a year behind me, a guy named Larry Harris, who's now full professor in finance at University of Southern California. He obviously did really well.
Yeah.
He went to Chicago, and I heard from him like, yeah, that's exactly what it was like, you know, like 90 or 100 people. They didn't even know who you were. And, you know, they just weeded people out through courses and then qualifiers. And if you survived the first year or so, eventually, you know, you could make it. But yeah, I think their attitude is, we'll admit a whole bunch of people and let the people who have what it takes identify themselves.
Right.
You know, you can see some virtue and
Totally.
You admit people that might look a little bit marginal on paper, but you give them a shot, right?
Yep.
There's a difference. But anyway, I didn't really want to do that. Northwestern had a much smaller class, and it was a very, very tough experience, but it was always clear that what they would love is if everybody did well enough
to continue.
So anyway,
Well, so aren't you at Northwestern at a really great time in econometrics history? Am I thinking of like John Rust and Goldberger? Am I wrong? Mansky?
Yeah, no, that's different. So, I showed up, and actually Mark Nerlove was there. Oh. He was my initial advisor. Just wonderful, wonderful, sweet, sweet man. But he overestimated my abilities. Like, oh, no, you don't want to take like the sort of statistics for economics class that econ offers and the metrics. You should be taking PhD level advanced statistics. Like, and I started thinking like, thank you for thinking so highly of me. I don't know if that's the wisest choice. So anyway, but yeah, at that time, so it was economic theory where Northwestern was really strong, and they had as like either brand new or very, very young assistant professors, Bengt Holmstrom, Paul Milgram.
Wow.
Meyerson, just an incredible.
Wow.
Founding set of talented people. Mark Sackrade, who ended up working with me, he was a bit farther along, obviously, but like just amazing, amazing people. And then they had Bob Eisner and Bob Gordon and Macro, and Mike Shearer was there in IO, and so in econometrics, so Nerlove was there. Steve Coslett, who had been a McFadden student, was there. And an older econometrician named Walter Fisher was there. So yeah, they didn't have the same set of characters, but they had
it was major league type stuff that you got. Right. Could you tell when you were there that you're like around some pretty heavyweight champs?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that. I mean, you know, I was.
Yeah. You're new just, yeah. 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 Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did I feel like I was in the presence of people who would win Nobel Prizes? No, that never occurred to me. Mort Kamian and Nancy Schwartz, blessed memory, were there. Glenn Lowry was there. Just took theory from Mort and from Glenn, micro theory. Both, I mean, like obviously incredibly smart, just amazing economic theorists, but also great teachers and incredibly patient, incredibly patient. I spent so much time in Glenn Lowry's office just trying to figure out what was going on.
Yeah.
Just felt like completely above my head. So we had great economic theory, great econometrics. And, you know, I didn't end up becoming a macroeconomist, and macro changed a lot. Actually, it was changing during that time. The rational expectations.
That's what you specialized in, was macro?
No. But, you know, we had to take macro theory.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Macro, we learned very quickly, became dated. On the other hand, I think we picked up some valuable stuff. IO changed a huge amount. What I was taught during IO sequence, you know, is now very, you know, became anachronistic very quickly. On the other hand, I really learned sort of basic economics and basic intuition and thinking very rigorously and hard, even if sort of the methodology, say what Mike Shearer taught and the kind of methods he used are not what's used in IO, haven't been some time, but taught to think very hard and very, very rigorously. And then Mark Pauly, does help, was there. And I completely stumbled into working on health economics. I started off thinking I'd like to do international action. And then I was looking for a summer job and somebody said, oh, you should go talk to Mark Pauly, walk down the street. He's got some project on the economics of hospitals and they need to hire research assistants. And I thought that sounds totally weird. Like economics, hospitals, these things have nothing to do with one another.
Right.
Which is kind of funny given I devoted a lot of my research career to working on the economics hospitals. But at the time I thought, what? That's crazy. Like, but you know what? I need a job. So I went down there and I talked to Mark, and I ended up working for somebody else, a guy named Phil Held, was a research economist there, and had some data that had been collected on physician group practices, medical group practices, that included information on how they divided up revenues and costs inside the group, you know, sort of what was the incentive or the mechanism by which they divide that up. And they ask them questions about things like risk preferences and other stuff. So an incredibly rich data set. I ended up writing my dissertation on this.
Oh, again, wow.
Not even knowing what I was getting into, but people were working on economics of organizations. And obviously there was a lot of work on incentives, theoretical, almost nothing empirical.
Yeah. Right? Oh.
So I ended up doing, I don't want to oversell it, right? But it's some very early work, empirical work on economics of incentives and contracts and payments and the impacts of those things that I just completely stumbled into. I had no idea I would do that. I had, like I said, they've working on health sounded very strange to me. Like,
Never did you immediately see the IO? Did you immediately see the market concentration questions when you were working on hospitals then, or was it?
That stuff I actually wasn't working on. So like I said, I worked on this stuff about payment mechanisms, you know, and incentives and trade-offs, you know, between risk and strength of incentives. And I wasn't really thinking about sort of market level stuff. I think of that as IO, if you start at sort of theory of the firm. That's an area where I say, you know, it touches IO, labor, public.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really one of those things that I think very much crosses field boundaries. But I thought it was as IO work, but it wasn't strict. It was not about markets and competition in those markets. And so I actually ended up working on competition and markets and ultimately antitrust stuff later in my career. It's something I told you I got excited about early on as an undergrad, but it ended up, that's not what I started working on initially.
Okay. So now kind of going into your career, you graduate and you jump around a little bit. You listed, you've been at three places at least. So where do you start out? And you were at Johns Hopkins second, right? Or was it first?
Oh, it's a long checkered.
Okay. So that's what I was wondering. Okay.
So I did not have a good start to my career. I'm very grateful. Actually, I ended up with opportunities along the way, but sort of briefly, here's what happened. So I left Northwestern in 1981. I was not done with my dissertation. Bad idea. Anybody yeah. listening, don't do that. And back in those days, it was not that unusual actually to leave and finish your dissertation the first year or so, but terrible idea. So I was hired as a visiting assistant professor at VPI, and now it's called Virginia Tech.
Uh-huh.
At that time, the Public Choice Center was there.
It was Jim the Buchanan Public Choice people.
Was there yeah. and all those folks. And they also-
that was like Gordon Tullock and Buchanan were both there?
Yeah, they were both there and then other people. But also the chair of the department was a guy named Dan Orr, who was an economic theorist. He'd actually been on the faculty at UCSD. He moved there and he brought in a bunch of theory people. So it was quite a good department.
Yeah.
At that time. Anyway, I'm a visitor there. I'm working on my dissertation. I'm there for a year. I don't finish it. My girlfriend, now my wife at the time, was back at Northwestern, and VPI, Virginia Tech, is in Blacksburg, Virginia, which is a beautiful spot, but there's nothing, no job opportunities there. Mm. So she and I decided we wanted to be together, and I looked for a job. I found a job at Rutgers Newark, the Newark campus of Rutgers. We said, okay, that's the greater New York area. That seems good. So I left VPI and I went to Rutgers Newark. I was an instructor there because I hadn't finished my dissertation. It turned out, unfortunately, this was the early 80s. There was a recession and my wife couldn't find decent work there either. But
she's an economist.
She had a bachelor's in economics, but she was just looking for, you know, just a regular job. Uh-huh. Things didn't go well for her in that regard. I was hired there, and on a one-year contract, they said, you got to finish your dissertation. Anyhow, I think the time rolled around. I hadn't finished it. I defended shortly after that, but the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Rutgers, New York, said, well, you're fired. So I actually got fired from there. I think he offered to let me stay on for a semester or a year, but it was clearly terminal. So, yeah. Anyway, eventually I did finish, but I then had to look for another job. So I looked for a job. I go on the market. I got a job offer as an assistant professor, a regular tenure track position at University of Texas at Arlington. So, well, you know, you live in Texas, so Arlington is halfway between Dallas and Fort Worth. It's where the baseball stadium was there then. Football was still over in Irving. So it was not nearly as developed and big, but you know, it's certainly big. So I got this job at UTA and it was a good job. I had, there were some other young people who had been hired at the time. The chairman's a guy named John Trapani who had been at Tulane and another IO guy, just a really good guy. Really
Are they
tried
calling to- you an IO guy? Are they saying, oh yeah, Marty's an IO guy?
Myself sort of IO and health. This is another part of the story. I sort of took a while to actually sort of calling myself health person. Mm-hmm. I'll digress a little better. So for a long time, when I came out I finally finished in 1983. I left Northwestern in 1981. Like I said, I bounce around, I get fired. I finish, so I have this tenure track position. But anyhow, at that time, it was really hard to get health stuff published in mainstream econ journals.
Oh, yeah.
RJPE, RESTAT, QJE, et cetera. And so it was really hard. It had to be about some general thing, but with an application. So health is an illustration. That has changed tremendously, right? If you look at the top five journals, even the more technical ones like RESTAT and even Econometrica, you'll see health applications in there. Yeah. But that was not the case. So I said, I'm an IO person. Yeah, I work on some health stuff. And actually, I did some other stuff. John Trapani and I wrote an airline paper. I did some stuff on decollectivization in the People's Republic of China. So I hadn't really completely settled. I was writing some theory stuff. I hadn't quite settled on what I wanted to be when I grew up. So I'm at Arlington, and then my wife decided she wanted to get a master's in economics, and SUNY Binghamton had a terminal master's program. Not that many places like that, like a professional Masters, it looked like a good fit. He gets accepted. So I say, okay, I go on leave from Arlington. And Binghamton said, well, we can have you as a visitor. We can pay you for one semester to teach something, but that's it. But you can hang out. So I said, okay, you know, so I go there. I'm basically a visitor yet again. I only am getting paid for one semester. And at this point, I still haven't published anything. 7 years past rolls around. I finally get something accepted, like a minor theory paper in managerial decision economics, which is a fine journal. But again, you may never have heard of it. And it's certainly not something that is going to get people all that excited if you haven't published anything after 7 years. So then my wife is going to finish her master's and look for a job. And at that point, you know, we're married and she's pregnant. And so I go on the market yet again. I say, well, we're not going back to Texas. That's too far away from family. And again, you know, this is just idiosyncratic preferences. The climate was not something that particularly agreed. You know, we're Yankees.
You're like a normal person. You know? It's too hot.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really, really, really hot.
Right.
We did a lot of cool things in Texas. We met some great people.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think, you know, we didn't decide that was not where we wanted to settle. So
totally.
At that point, I'm on the market. I, you know, how many, the nth time, nothing to show for it. I end up out of academia. I got a job with a research firm called Health Economics Research, Inc., a mom and pop place in the greater Boston area. They did a lot of work for Medicare, what's now CMS. It was called something different. At that point, Medicare had changed the way they pay hospitals, radical change. We were involved in an evaluation of this. So anyway, we're living in the Boston area for 2 years. We have our first child there.
You thinking, Marty, well, in a previous life, I was an academic.
That's still what I wanted to do. I was still working on trying to publish a paper out of my dissertation.
Uh-huh.
I was still working on that. And then I get a call. I had met a guy named Richard Frank. Oh, I know.
There was a
Boston area health econ seminar that had been started by Paul Gertler, who's now at Berkeley, mm-hmm. was at Harvard Public Health. There was a guy named Ken Thorpe there, who's now at Emory. I think Randy Ellis and Tom McGuire at BU, and I think David Cutler maybe and John Gruber were like brand new assistant professors, mm-hmm. maybe, or maybe not. Maybe they were still in grad school. Anyhow, this thing starts, get started. I start going to these things.
Richard, when was this?
This would have been 1985, 86, 87.
Okay.
Something like that. So mid 80s.
Yeah.
Richard was at Johns Hopkins Public Health School. I think I meet him because he came up to give a talk. Anyhow, they had been trying to recruit for somebody doing economics and mental health. And apparently they just then found it. They made off
such a thin market for that, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's right. And so anyway, he calls me and said, would you be interested? And I said, well, I don't know anything about this. I never thought about it. And so he said, well, that's okay. You don't have to, you do have to be willing to work on it. And I said, well, you know, why not? I mean, we talked about it and I'll be honest, Scott, I didn't know much about it at the time, but I quickly became aware this is a huge deal.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, about social issues, right?
Yeah.
You know, one in five among us has experienced an episode of serious mental illness at least once during their life. It's a huge deal. And there also had not been a lot of work by economists on this. Mm-hmm. Tom McGuire had done work on this. There are not very many people working on it. So like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And there's, you know, huge public role there. So a lot of potential to do some good public economics.
Mm-hmm.
So, I didn't really want to continue in the job at this firm I was at, both because I preferred academia, and it was a mom and pop place, and so it just wasn't working out for me.
Yeah,
all that well. So lo and behold, I've been out 7 years. I got this one paper.
Is it a tenure track job at Johns Hopkins?
It's a tenure track job.
I get
incredibly lucky
in the econ department. in the econ.
Not in the public health school.
In the public health school. Got it.
Eventually, I had a joint appointment with econ. Bruce Hamilton was the chair of economics at the time. It was still called the Department of Political Economy. The acronym for that DOPE is not the most felicitous acronym, but it's now just economics. But anyhow, so Bruce gave me a joint appointment, and actually I got to teach PhD IO, PhD Empirical. Oh. Joe Harrington, who's now at Penn, was at Hopkins. And of course, he's a marvelous economic theorist. Joe taught the theory semester, and then I taught the empirical semester. So
does it all just start to come together? Like at Johns Hopkins, your papers start hitting and stuff?
And I finally get something written up out of my thesis, and I submit it, and eventually gets accepted at Rand. And at that point, you know, the dam broke, or I got over the hump.
Yeah.
I think also like being at Hopkins, both being able to talk to people like Richard, David Salkiever, other people in public health, Joe Harrington, and others in economics. I mean, having colleagues of that caliber makes a real difference.
Totally.
And then, you know, as you know, I think there were really good economists every single place I was at. Virginia Tech, Rutgers, Newark, Texas at Arlington, SUNY Binghamton, Health Economics Research Inc., really good people doing really good work every single place. And I benefited from interactions with those people in all those places. It really helped me in many ways, even if I didn't always appreciate it at the time.
Yeah.
But there are advantages from being at a place that is recognized as being in the pecking order.
Yeah.
Economics. I'll be honest. So I think, you know, you send something in, even if you're not in the econ department, you're at Johns Hopkins. It makes a difference.
It gets a second look.
It gets a second look.
And you're probably, and you're like, you're not writing the same papers at Johns Hopkins than you would be if you weren't at Johns Hopkins. You got these colleagues, you got these students that are smart.
I would talk to Carl Crist of blessed memory in the hallway. I mean, one of the, you know, all-time great econometricians and most wonderful human beings ever to exist on the face of this planet, just incredibly generous with me. Mm. You know, and that the department would bring through Sherwin Rosen, Dan McFadden, you know, you get to talk to these people.
That's unreal.
So there are advantages that accrue to you, some of them completely unearned, by virtue of being at a place that has name recognition and resources and connections, that there are benefits. It's just the honest truth.
Well, you know, I mean, this thing in your personality that's really coming across, if I don't mind saying it, is very optimistic. But the, you know, that would be one way of putting it. But it's also, it seems like it's very resilient. You know, you're like, you're kind of hanging in there. And even when you like leave and are now kind of like, man, maybe I shouldn't have left. Now I'm like at this, I'm visiting, I got this. You just kind of kept hustling, or you just like, you're not really, you don't really give up at all. Is that, one of your attributes?
Yeah, I guess so. Again, I sort of has, it's a little weird talking about oneself, and I don't want to sound like I'm blowing my own horn, but I think persistence is really important. I mean, look, even if your first job is at MIT or Stanford, you still have to be persistent. You're going to get slapped across the face, even if you, you know, have the privilege of being at one of these places. But I think I learned that. And I think the other thing that's really important that is that, like I said, you know, there are places that are pretty far down pecking order in economics or aren't recognized. There are good people all these places. I had really good colleagues at Rutgers, Newark, at Texas, at Arlington, all of these places. I benefited from interacting with all these people and were people who were very, very generous with their time and their input and feedback, and really helped me a great deal at every single place. So I think the profession has gotten a lot better than it used to be. But there is there is still, I think, a certain, there is a pecking order, and some
absolutely
and to look down. I mean, you're at Baylor, which is it's a good place, but you know, it's not Michigan.
Yeah, totally. No, I get it. It can get in your head too. It can get in your head and you can, but it seems like, you know, I just keep thinking all of, as you recount these things, you keep saying the things you got from it. And it just reminds me, you know, you seem like someone that is either it's coming naturally or you choose to let go of this, let go of some things and then like really be salient about the gifts from it.
You know, I don't know.
I know you're a normal person too.
I know my father was truly an optimist. He faced some real adversity he was a depression era kid. Things did not go well, for my grandparents in many, many ways. My grandfather, blessed memory, had failed business after failed business after failed business. But he picked himself up
and kept going.
He kept trying. My dad faced setbacks in any number of ways, but he was always an optimist. I'm not saying like he was always cheerful and all the time, but he was someone who really always felt like, things were looking up. He found the positive and he would work to find the positive. And I'm sure that had a big influence on me.
I mean, it's like, you don't really notice that you're doing it, but other people can kind of notice it.
As a parent, you know, you do so many things and some of them are deliberate. You're trying to imbue our kids with our values. Some of them, you know, you're just who you are.
Yeah.
And you hope that some of that's good. The other thing I think it's important to say that I want people to hear is that nobody does this alone.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want to give the impression like, oh, you know, I'm so resilient on this and that. Yeah, okay, I will take credit. I think I honestly do deserve some credit. But you think of all the people you interact with and either like the sort of one-offs or the persistent, people have been so giving to me professionally and personally over the years in every way, shape, and form. When I was at Rutgers Newark, Mike Grossman, who was at the Graduate Center, City University for Work, was the head of the health economics program at NBER. There was no healthcare program, just health economics. Mike did not know who I was. I was nobody. I was less than nobody. He gave me a faculty research fellow appointment at NBER, a desk to sit at the New York office, which was on Mercer Street at an NYU building. I would go in a couple days a week. And that made a huge difference because I could put paper with yellow covers.
Absolutely. Yep.
And Mike didn't have to do that.
Yep.
You know,
he's as generous as they come.
My work is not, you know, as you know, Mike works on human capital. I mean, he's the guy who came up with the human capital model of health, working with Gary Becker when Gary was an advisor at Columbia. I don't work on the kind of stuff Mike works on.
Right.
Right. So there was nothing in it for him. He was who he is.
Yeah.
And so there's so many people like that. I'm in so many people. And that's
and maybe this is one of the mechanisms where underrepresented minorities and women get tagged, you know, because that the distribution of resiliency, you could just imagine that's like got a very thick distribution. A lot of people are resilient. But if what you're saying is right, that there's these complementarities that make it really work, which is that, you know, a person does kind of have to believe that like it will work to keep at it, you know?
And you have to get your foot in the door at least a little bit.
Yeah, you have to get your foot in the door a little bit.
Again, I think the profession is much better than it used to be. I think back in the day was a lot of implicit bias, I don't want to deny explicit, but a lot of implicit bias. I think we're much better now, but I'm glad you raised that. We have to be very, very cognizant of that. Again, I'm not trying to say I'm so great, but I'm really grateful. I had the opportunity to serve as a mentor through the Research in Color Foundation, which tried to facilitate getting folks of color into the profession. And now I'm a mentor of the, I forget the long name of the AEA.
AEA one, yeah.
Minority, status of minorities. Mm-hmm. They have mentors. And so, again, I'm grateful for that opportunity, because if I can help provide some connections, or even just, you know, people talk now, they've come up with words, the unwritten curriculum.
Totally, there's, the hidden curriculum, yep.
I mean, I tell our students that what you're doing is science, but how to do it and how to behave professionally, that's a craft.
Right.
And that's, you can't pick up a book, right? You have to learn by doing, and having people who help you along the way makes such a huge difference.
You have to be around people. And if you're already kind of being siloed out,
yeah,
you don't even see it, and you don't know what in the heck. Other people just hit the ground running for all kinds of reasons, but some of it is these kinds of reasons.
Right. I mean, I've had so many second chances.
Right.
That I just came out of nowhere. I had no, I didn't deserve, right?
Yeah.
I was very fortunate. They came my way, but I'm also very aware of the fact that I'm a man and I'm white.
Yeah, yeah, right? Totally. No, I completely hear you.
White racists do not consider me as a Jew white, but
yeah,
putting that off to the side, I have advantages other people don't have. But anyway, I've gotten lots of second chances, mm-hmm. and it would be very different otherwise. The other thing that's important to say, I think, is that having an academic career is not the most important thing in the world, and having tenured position at a university that's somewhere, you know, in the higher up in the food chain. Oh, that's kind of a nice thing. That's not the most important thing in the world. Great jobs. There are lots of ways to contribute to society, have satisfying careers.
Yeah.
I happen to have found something I enjoy and has worked for me. But, you know, when I was coming out of grad school, my highest ambition was to get a job at the Rand Corporation and play volleyball on the beach at lunchtime.
That's
Southern California. That
17-year-old 3-0
average kid. I was like, dang, that sounds pretty awesome, you know, hang out on the beach. Well, I interviewed with Rand. They didn't offer me a job, so it didn't happen.
They heard about you making hand gliders when you were a kid. They were worried about you weren't going to be there for much longer.
They talked to my high school guidance counselor.
Exactly. They were like, no, don't do it. Well, this is a more serious transition, but, you know, I did want to, at least for a little bit, talk about the Tree of Life Synagogue. Before we get into that day, how long had you been attending the Tree of Life Synagogue, and what was that community like?
Yeah.
Maybe still like.
So the Tree of Life Synagogue building at that time housed three different congregations. So the Tree of Life congregation itself, I'm not a member of that congregation. I'm a member of that congregation, actually, in another congregation here named Beth Shalom. And then a New Light. So New Light, Dor Chadash, and Tree of Life were in the building
Oh, they shared a space
on that day. Yeah. So Dor Chadash and New Light were renting space because the Tree of Life was their building. So we had been in that building, oh golly, for a while now. Dor Chadash has been a number of different places, but a while. It was, you know, it was home.
How big was your community, your congregation?
It's gotten a lot, actually. Interestingly enough, the congregation has grown substantially.
I'm not surprised.
I couldn't.
But you were close. You felt like connected to a community.
So the group that would come on Sabbath morning, Saturday is, of course, the Jewish Sabbath, about somewhere between, I'll say, 10 to 25 people. You need at least 10 people to hold a formal service. Sometimes we get 10. We were, and the room we were in was right across the hall from the room that Tree of Life congregation used. If we didn't have a quorum, in Hebrew it's a minyan or minyan, you need 10 people, we would oftentimes just go across the hall,
grab somebody.
to the Tree of Life service. So we knew those people very well. I saw those people quite a bit. We saw them on the Sabbath, on holidays. I knew many of them. Certainly conversation, some of them better than that. New Light had moved into the building fairly recently. They had had their own building for a long time, but their congregation had been getting smaller and smaller, and they made the decision to sell their building. I don't think I didn't really know people in that congregation beforehand. I wasn't even really cognizant of the fact they, I mean, I knew they were in the building, but I didn't, it's a relatively new thing. So so there was a group of say 12-ish to 20-ish regulars, or 12 to 15-ish people that came on a regular basis, and then there'd be other people that would show up. So so not a huge group. I mean, you know, large enough, but sort of small enough that you really knew people very, very well. On that day, I was with two friends.
This is Dan, October 27th, 2018.
Yeah, the whole thing was, again, in some ways interesting. So I had been in Portland, Maine, and come back the day before. One thing I had done a few years ago was I helped found a nonprofit called the Healthcare Cost Institute.
Uh-huh.
Startup. So I guess I'm a social entrepreneur.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And that got data from three of the five largest health insurance companies in the United States for research on healthcare utilization and expenditures. Anyway, I had, I'd been the first chair of the governing board and just basically got the thing off the ground. When I joined the Federal Trade Commission in 2013, the Healthcare Cost Institute, I'll use the acronym HCCI, starting in 2011, I resigned because I couldn't do that when I was up. See, I mean, first off, but it, you know, it wouldn't have been appropriate. So they had a board meeting in Portland, Maine, and they invited me to come and attend. And I knew all the people, and then they gave me an award. And we went to the Allagash Brewery, which is this craft brewery that was there. And one of the people actually knew the master brewer, gave us this incredible tour. Anyway, and Portland is just a beautiful jewel box of a city. It was a beautiful day. And I get back Friday afternoon, plenty of time for the Sabbath. Everything was like great, going great. So I go to the synagogue Saturday morning, and my friends, Dan Legger and Jerry Rabinowitz of blessed memory, were there. And we were just getting set up for people coming in. And then we had, you know, everything set up, we started at 10. It was 10 of 10. It wasn't yet time. When things started, and we were just sitting around telling jokes. Dan says we were telling bad jokes. I disagree with that. I was telling good jokes, but anyway, we're just laughing, kidding around, telling jokes, having a relaxed, you know, anytime you're somewhere where like you're having a meeting or, you know, a gathering, and you're some people are there beforehand and you're waiting for everybody else, you sit around, you kid around.
Yeah,
talk.
Yeah, you're with your friends. Yeah,
exactly. Very relaxed. And then at 10 of 10, everything started happening.
What? So you heard a noise. Did you immediately know what it was?
So no. I believe this had been corroborated by Dan. I think we heard the same thing, and other people who were there and survived. There are 11 of us who survived out of 22. So we heard something one thing, just a piece of detail. Out in the hallways, there are a couple of different places. There are these metal coat racks. They look like they're from 1952 or something. These gigantic things. They're on wheels, but they're the big, heavy things. And we heard a sound that sounded to me like something heavy made of metal falling over.
Mm-hmm.
And what I thought, there are a lot of older people that attend, and the older people older than me anyway.
Yeah.
Praise God, 68 years old. So I'm an older person, but of course this was 5 years ago. So
yeah.
I was a wet behind the ears youngster then. Now, I thought, oh gosh, what happened? Maybe somehow one of these coat racks fell over, and maybe it fell on somebody or something. Right. It just was like, that's what it sounded like. And
it must have been unusually loud, though.
Yeah, it was loud. We definitely, definitely heard it. And we all looked at each other, and then we heard another sound. It didn't sound the same. It sounded to me more like something like a big, heavy bookshelf felt. But
does it get? Okay. So how many are in your room?
It's just Jerry and Dan and me, just the three people. Just I mean, there were other people in other spaces in the building.
Yeah. So
I wasn't really aware of who else was there. I walked in at the same time as Dan and then two other people, Audrey Glickman and Joe Charney from Tree of Life, but I didn't see anybody else. I didn't know who else was there. So we all looked at each other and we got up and we headed to the door because I don't think we exchanged words, but it was pretty clear to me. We all thought the same thing. What's going on? This is weird. Maybe somebody is hurt and needs help. So
the last thing that you can think of is that this could be a shooter.
No, because it didn't sound like that.
It didn't sound like it.
No, yeah. No, just these sounds. I mean, I was explained to me later by, I don't know if it was the FBI or, I mean, law enforcement folks, anyhow, that's actually, those are sounds that can result from that, but it wasn't identifiable to me. So anyway, we went out the door, Jerry, Dan, me, we get out in the hallway, and then I heard gunshots. Mm. I recognized gunshots, no question in my mind. They were gunshots and not 22s. I've shot 22 rifles, like, you know, Boy Scout camp, things like that. But also my sons and I were in father stun stuff through the Y. And one of the things we did was go shoot 22s at a right range. So I know.
You're familiar with that. This was not that.
I mean, I don't own guns. I don't fire guns all the time, but I have some familiarity. I know what it sounds like. And I've heard, you know, larger weapons being fired too. So from a very powerful firearm.
He had a machine gun or like a handgun?
Assault style weapon and handguns.
It was pretty big.
At this point, the rifle was being used. Got it.
Okay.
But that's my understanding anyhow.
Yeah.
So a couple years before that, I had attended a training session on active shooters at the university.
Oh. Really?
So the university police do this on a regular basis. Most faculty ignore it and don't attend.
Yeah.
I and only one other faculty member and I attended that. A number of our staff members attended that as well. And I heard the shots. And the next thing I knew, I had turned around and I was running the other way. It just happened. So that saved my life.
They tell you to do that?
Run, hide, fight. Run, hide.
You had that? I mean, because the fight or flight freeze response seems almost impossible to overcome in a situation like that.
All I can tell you, Scott, is it happened. It wasn't initially, it was not conscious. It just happened.
What about your friends? They're not doing that?
They went the other way.
They went towards the sounds?
They went towards the sound. Of course, Jerry, a blessed memory, is not here to tell us, but Dan says that he felt like there was something. He felt that Jerry was a physician, Dan is a nurse, and they were going to help.
Sure. That's their fighter. That's their response to a
situation like that. Which is totally admirable, of course. Yeah,
sure.
Of course, and nobody knew what was going on because
no
line of sight. There were just these sounds. Don't know if they recognized this was the sound of a firearm, but I mean, it was obvious something was amiss. This was not normal. Mm. So this just happened. And I turned around and I ran in the opposite direction. And fortunately I was able to get out some doors down a hall. At that point in time, of course, nobody knew what was going on. I knew that there was somebody shooting a firearm. I don't know who it was or what they were doing. And it was a domestic dispute. I had no idea.
Yeah.
I also did not know if there were other people, if there might be somebody outside.
Yes.
Waiting. But
yes.
I just burst through the doors and kept going. And then I crossed a major intersection and got down to a side street. And when I got to the side street and turned the corner, a car pulled up with a woman and a teenage boy. I didn't have my phone with me. I didn't carry my phone. We don't, or at least some people don't use electricity on the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. So I asked her to call 911, and she called, and then I talked to 911. I was very fortunate. I have a very, very slight wound that in my one of my elbows. I was hit by a piece of shrapnel, but really? very, very slight. Oh. I didn't even know it had happened at the time, but I thank God every single day. I'm so grateful that I'm here. Of course, Jerry did not make it. Dan, my friend Dan, was severely, severely wounded. He was in the hospital for a long time, but thank God he is with us. But, I've always expressed gratitude at the beginning of every single day just for being here and for everything I'm given. But needless to say, I feel that perhaps a bit more profoundly.
Yes.
Since that day. It took a long time, of course, to figure out what was going on. Nobody sure. knew what was happening.
How do you think this whole thing changed you? What do you think this is? What's the legacy of this in your life?
Yeah. I'll start with the positives, and it's sort of, look, this was absolutely horrific, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you had mass shooting, 11 people were murdered in cold blood, and it's anti-Semitic incident, the worst ever in the history of the United States, at least as far as we know. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are worse things, but yeah. This gets pretty high up on
list. This is very horrible. Yes.
What would be a terrible, awful thing to have? What would make for a no good, terrible, horrible day? Well,
right.
This is one of them, certainly. But there were some incredible blessings that came through that. So one thing that happened actually starting almost immediately afterwards is people started coming forward and offering assistance in various ways. And that has continued to this very day. So that certainly demonstrated that the overwhelming majority of people in Pittsburgh, in the United States, in the world are really good, kind, caring people. Yes, there are some bad people. And let's be honest, there are some evil people. There is evil in the world. We don't like to think about it. And most of us are fortunate enough never to encounter it directly. Mm-hmm. It's there. But that is a distinct minority. Most people are really, really good, decent, and caring people. And so that one thing, this permitted me to see this both directly and indirectly. Things I either got from people or heard from people or became aware of indirectly. The whole community in Pittsburgh came behind us. Actually, the very first group to speak up and do something, like as soon as it became public, was folks from the Islamic Center of Pittsburgh. Led by a guy named Wazi Muhammad, who was the director. Now he's a staff member for one of our representatives in Congress, but just an amazing person, just a wonderful, wonderful person. Mm. And he, of course, the whole congregation there, with not just him, but they said, hey, first off, they started raising money immediately and raised tens of thousands of dollars in a mere hours. They said, anybody in the Jewish community who feels uncomfortable anyway, let us know. We will escort you anywhere. You want to go to the library, supermarket, you want to go to synagogue, we'll be there. We don't want you to be afraid. And then group after group after group, our Christian neighbors, our Hindu neighbors, our Buddhist neighbors, everybody, the sports teams, of course, the most important religion in Pittsburgh is the Pittsburgh Steelers. Sorry. Priests, ministers, rabbis, imams, spiritual leaders, no offense intended, but they all know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I think the hockey team, the Penguins, I think had the first game, and they had some symbol. They had a ceremony. Steelers followed and so on and so forth. The whole community and then everybody across the United States and around the world. So that was an incredible gift to be shown that. I'd say, perhaps to just the gift of being here, right? Mm-hmm. Something perhaps we don't appreciate in the way maybe we should all the time, but it should or shouldn't be here isn't the right term, but very, very easily, it's a matter of seconds, and I either wouldn't be here or I would have been very severely wounded, a lot of my friends. Well, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm very grateful for that. And I have appreciation for that. And it's made very, very clear to me just how important it is how we treat each other and how just even a little bit of kindness and caring is absolutely so important. It's, I think we all have these impulses within us. You know, we're sort of, you know, tribal or whatever you want to put it. We have a tendency to distrust and maybe be fearful of those we're not familiar with. Even like a new person comes into the group. You'll see this like junior high school behavior. Tries to sit at the lunch table and people shun them. Well, then if somebody looks different, right? Their skin is a different color. Their hair looks different. Their clothing's different. The food they eat is different. They, you know, go to a different place to pray, whatever it may be. We tend to be suspicious and a little fearful and we can be, bigoted, judgmental, mm-hmm. bigoted, prejudiced, and hateful. And it's easy to succumb to those kind of things, sometimes in very small ways, but slippery slope.
Yep.
And I think, you know, we just have to, in the negative, be, you know, very careful about not letting that happen. I think it can happen to anybody, one. And two, really focus on just trying to be decent to people. Just take another tiny moment here, right? No one of us can change the world by ourselves.
Yeah.
But what can we do? Well, for whatever short time we're here, we can make the world a little bit nicer place. Just if we smile at somebody, if we hold the door open for somebody, if we take the time to ask a colleague or a neighbor how they're doing, or, you know, are they, have they been ill? How is their parent doing? There's sort of so many tiny little things that can make a difference. And so that's something did I never not know any of that before? No. But it's really become clear to me how important those things are.
Yeah. Well, I'm so appreciative of I am so sorry about your close loved ones in that day and what your family, how it hurt you so bad. I don't have the words for it. And I'm so grateful that you're here and thankful for your public service. You're now, what would the feds call, like during Prohibition, it's like the fuzz or what was like the when you're a fed, you're a fed now, right? You're like a law enforcement.
Yeah. We're not, back in the day, they actually used to go around like and sort of like do raids, like the FTC had places where they would store stuff. Like there was this, the fur industry in New York got taken over by the mob and they went after them on any trust grounds.
Oh, they did.
In collusion.
Right.
But then they confiscated a whole bunch of furs and they, so.
You're not going to get to do that? That's not one of the perks? Happen.
In my mind's eye, when I was at the FTC, I said, you know, issue me a windbreaker. Can I pull off on a raid? Wouldn't that be? So that
didn't happen. They phased that out.
Wow. Yeah, that doesn't happen anymore. It wouldn't be the role that economists play. But, you know, I feel I personally have benefited tremendously from everything the citizens of this country have done, right? I mean, the education, I got the public safety. I mean, this place, my grandparents were all immigrants. This country welcomed us. I'm not saying it was easy. They didn't face prejudice, but yeah. this country has been really, really good to my family. And I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to give something back. And try and do some good for the country and for the citizens of the country. And that's really what this is about. I mean, the antitrust enforcement, you know, we're trying to make markets work to the benefit of the citizens of the United States. And more often than not, I mean, markets do work pretty well, but you need entities there watching to try and prevent bad things from happening, or if bad things from happening, trying to stop those or undo those, and also to try and promote policies that make things work better. So if I can contribute even in a small way to that, that certainly for me is deeply meaningful.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. What a great feeling to know that all that skill and human capital that you've accumulated puts you in a rare position to do something that would really make a difference. That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm really grateful I got these opportunities. And both 10 years ago and when this happened, it was literally a phone call out of the blue. I wasn't expecting it, didn't anticipate it. I took graduate IO at Northwestern from Mike Shearer, who had been the director of the Bureau of Economics at the FTC, actually just a few years before that. And I never dreamed that I would have the opportunity to work in that role in the same way that my professor, my graduate professor, had done. I'm not saying I'm of that stature at all, but just I didn't have any ambition towards that. Didn't even occur to me to be given the opportunity, nor again, this sort of second time around, as it were, with DOJ, I didn't expect I would have the opportunity to serve the country again. I'm really grateful for that.
Mm. Well, I am too. Well, thank you so much, Marty. It's so nice to talk. Next time you're in Texas, I'll get you some barbecue and try to talk you out of all that stuff you said about the Steelers. Try to help you remember where you came from.
yes, indeed. Well, I know in Texas, or at least in the greater Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex, the Cowboys.
That's are right.
Religion is well, and I understand and respect that. Yeah.
All right. Well, you have a great day.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. It's really good to be able to talk and chat together. And I'm looking forward to the day where we finally get to meet each other.
Yes, I am too. I am excited about that. All right. You have a great day.